everybody, and welcome to the Society Library. My name is Betty Sargent, and I have the great pleasure of being on the board of this wonderful institution. So, tonight, you all know who's with us, and I am very pleased to have the honor of introducing Mr. Winchester, and I'd like to tell you very briefly, can everybody hear, about what happened to me at lunch today. I'm an editor by trade, and I belong to a group of publishing people who have lunch together once a month. So I was at my lunch today, sitting next to a distinguished literary agent named John Silberstack, and I told him I was excited about tonight, and Simon Winchester was going to be with us, and how thrilling this was for everybody. And he said, "Well, you know the Larry Ashmead story, don't you?" And I said, "No." Larry Ashmead was a distinguished editor in New York City, a very dear friend of mine and of Simon Winchester's. In 1998, Larry was in London at his biannual trip to England to see if there's anything over there that those English people were publishing that we should know about. And on the back of one publisher's desk was a book proposal. And it had an odd title, and Larry was very interested in odd things. And so he said, "Well, let me the publisher was about to toss it out. Nobody was interested. This is too bizarre. We don't care about this." So Larry said, "Well, can I just take this with me back to New York and take a look at it, and I'll be in touch with you." So he read this bizarre manuscript on the airplane. He got to New York. He called up Simon, and he said, "I'm going to publish your book." And that book was The Professor and the Madman. Isn't that a great story? So we are very honored to have with us tonight Simon Winchester, who's going to talk to us about his new book on skulls, a whole different subject. This is a man who is a magical storyteller, a brilliant researcher, and we are really honored to have him here with us. Thank you.
Very much indeed. That was extremely generous of you. Thank you. This is very much a departure for me. I've never written a book like it. And one of the odd things that's happened as a consequence is that people keep coming up and giving me things to identify. And this happened to me about 2 weeks ago in Portland, in Oregon. A woman had an enormous shopping bag, and she came up and said, "Can I show you this, and would you help identify it for me?" And it was, it was spilling out of the shopping bag. It was an enormous skull with great horny things. And I said, "Well, it's fairly obvious what it is. It's an elk." And she was enormously relieved and went away. But that allowed me to tell in Portland a story that I'd long forgotten. And the story doesn't have a great deal to do with skulls. It has a tiny bit to do with skulls. But it so broke the ice with the audience that I've actually told it once or twice since. And although, if you'll excuse me, it doesn't have a great deal, it's got a lot to do with elk, but very little to do with skulls, I hope you'll indulge me and allow you to tell me. It was a rather bizarre story. It happened, I was living in New York at the time. This was 1980, May. And I got a telephone call from a newspaper in England saying, would I go immediately to Washington State, and specifically to Mount St. Helens, and it was the 14th of May. If you remember, Mount St. Helens exploded on the 18th of May. And we want you to interview this chap called Harry Truman, who you may possibly remember, not Harry S. Truman, but Harry R. Truman, who was the curator and had since 1927 been the curator of the Spirit Lake Lodge at the very summit of the mountain, and who refused point blank to leave the mountain. Dixie Lee Ray, who was the governor of Washington State at the time, had declared a total exclusion zone because clearly the mountain was just about to explode, and the only person remaining on the mountain was this cantankerous old gentleman, Harry Truman, who lived there with 16 cats and seemed to us, in England anyway, to have the makings of a rather good story. So, knowing that we were forbidden from going there, I nonetheless thought, well, you know, we're English and don't understand the niceties of American law. I'm sure we can manage to talk our way out of it. So we flew to Portland and rented a car from Hertz, drove north up to Longview, turned right, and began ascending the mountain, which was smoking and bubbling and looking fairly ominous. And we came after about 4 miles to a barrier across the road, which said it is illegal to go any further. But both to the left and the right of the barrier, you could see sort of vague pathways through the woods. So I turned, I think, to the right and went with this Hertz car through the woods and eventually got up back onto the asphalt again, now up above this barrier, and continued up the road. And then we came to a much more formidable barrier, barbed wire and a skull and crossbones. So there is actually a skull dimension to this story, saying it is dangerous, you're not allowed to go, enormous fines will be imposed on you, you'll go to prison, you mustn't go any further. But we knew Harry Truman was on the other side somewhere, so we were determined to go. It was impossible to go to the right of the barrier, but through the left you could vaguely see a sort of track through the road. So the photographer climbed over the fence and the barbed wire and landed on the other side. And this car, I mean, actually, the irresponsible thing to say, but it didn't belong to, you know, it belonged to Mr. and Mrs. Hertz, so I thought, what the heck? And I gunned it down through a sort of a ditch and then up the other side, and it progressed for about maybe 10 feet before a terrible bang, and it stuck itself, the sump, firmly on a stump that I hadn't seen projecting from the ground, and I could neither reverse nor go forward. So I was, if I can use an anglicism, which I'm sure you're familiar with, I was well and truly buggered. So I got out of the car, I left it, I joined the photographer on the road, and we walked up. And it was extremely unpleasant, because it was just like walking up on the deck of a ship, because the road was an enormous amount of motion underneath the volcano, and there was steam gushing out of fumaroles on either side. It was a sort of Dantean view. But we walked up this road and got to the Spirit Lake Lodge, and there was Harry Truman, and there were his cats. And so we took lots of photographs of him and interviewed him, and how he was defiant about how he'd never leave. He was born on the mountain. He was going to die on the mountain. Of course, he did precisely that 4 days later. So we got what we needed. And we turned around after half an hour when we really wanted just to get back to some semblance of safety, and walked back down the road and came to the barrier, on the other side of which was a police car with its lights flashing, and a very tall, very large officer who clearly had a major sense of humour failure, and said, what do you think you're doing here? And we said, we're from England, as if that was any kind of excuse. And he said, well, I don't care where you're from, but you're not supposed to be here, and basically you're under arrest. And first of all, I assume this is your car. We've got to get it back on the road and get it out of here. And so what I'm going to do, whether you like it or not, is call a tow truck from Longview. He will not wish to come up here, but I will order him to do so. He will charge at least $1,000 in cash, so I hope you've got some cash on you. Sure enough, so an hour or so later, up comes this chap. He, with consummate ease, lifts the car off the tree stump and plonks it on the road, and then takes $1,000 in cash for doing so. And then the policeman explains what's going to happen. He says, I am going to go first, and in my car, and you are going to follow. You are under arrest, and we will go to the station in Longview. You will be booked, arraigned, you will go to the court, and then we'll see whether you're going to spend the night in jail. But basically, you're in big trouble. So we followed him down the road, and we came eventually to the second barrier, which had been the first one. Of course, he had a padlock key, and he unlocked it, and we swept through, and he locked it up again, and we continued down for about another mile, when suddenly he slammed on his brakes and got out of the car with a rifle. And we thought, well, it was only trespassing. I mean, it wasn't, I mean, America has got strange sort of attitudes towards this kind of thing, but he said, no, don't worry. He said, look, I've just seen over in the woods to my right, it's out of season, but I've just seen a lot of elk. And basically, I'd like to shoot one of them. But the trouble is that it's impossible, as well as unseemly, to put a dead elk on the top of a police car because of that big gantry of lights. So the deal is this. If I succeed in getting an elk, I would like to put it on top of your car, and then we'll think again about the charges that I'm bringing against you. So we sat in the car listening to the radio, and then 5 or 10 minutes later there was a crump of an explosion, and he came running and beckoned to us, and I've never touched an elk in my life before, but we were hauling this dead beast and up on the top of our car, and he had some string, and he put its legs through the windows, and we tied it all together. And so we progressed, and we didn't go to the police station at all. We went to his house, and his wife gave us a cup of tea. We unloaded the elk in the garage, and he said, all charges have been dismissed. Have a nice day. So it was. It has nothing to do with skulls, but I couldn't resist to telling you. And I bless the woman that brought the skull to me in Portland. So on to skulls specifically. This all began about 3 years ago when I got a telephone call from a friend of mine called Max Whitby in London, who has a company that makes apps. Actually, the name of the company is at the top left there, Touch Press. And he's done a lot of remarkable apps, a very clever chap. And he said, I want you to read today's Daily Mail. Now, the Daily Mail, as I'm sure you all know, is the most popular online newspaper in the English-speaking world. It is hugely and wantonly irresponsible. It's frequently deeply inaccurate. It's a typical English tabloid newspaper, the kind of thing that was excoriated by the Leveson inquiry that reported just last week. But it had a story in it, the details of which I'll tell you in a moment, about a man called Alan Dudley who had a remarkable collection of skulls. And Max said to me, this chap is so extraordinary, I think we ought to do an app on him. So I read a bit more about him and went over to London a couple of days later. And he lives in Coventry, which is an extremely dull industrial city in the English Midlands. And he lives in a very ordinary suburban street there. And he is, it never ceases to amaze me, the jobs that people have. He, for the last 30 years, has had as his full-time employment, he selects the veneers which go on the dashboards of Jaguar motor cars. So if you buy a Jaguar and sort of admire the walnut or whatever it is, Alan Dudley, who's 57, I think, would have selected it. During the evening, however, he has, and for the last 30-odd years, he has been collecting skulls. And I asked him immediately how it all started, and he said that, like all English schoolboys, he collected newts and tadpoles and frog spawn and that sort of stuff. And he also watched religiously the wildlife programs of David Attenborough, which you see over here in this country. And so he was interested in a typical sort of young boy way with wildlife. And he was walking home one day, and he was about 18 at the time, and he saw beside the road a body of a red fox, which had clearly been killed in a traffic accident. And he thought to himself, I wouldn't mind stuffing this, learning the craft of taxidermy, and this is a beautiful thing. But he picked it up, and he noticed that it, you know, many of its ribs were broken and a big gash in its side, obviously being hit by a motor car or something. So he thought that taxidermy probably wouldn't work. But then he made the decision which separates Alan Dudley from what I suspect is most of us in this room. He said, well, in that case, I'll cut its head off and try and prepare its skull. In this talk, there isn't too much which is disgusting. I mean, it's a slightly macabre subject, but the next couple of minutes you might find a little tiny bit offensive. He took this head of this fox, and with his penknife he cut away the fur and then the muscles underneath, and he reached in its mouth and cut out its tongue and the eyes and so forth, and eventually scraped it. And I'm going to have to be doing a lot of this evening, so I hope you don't mind. So I want to show you what came up as a result. In fact, if you can hear me, I might do a bit of this from here. You can you? Good. All right, well, this is what he came up with. That was his first ever skull, and as you can see, after all the grotesqueries of taking off the fur and stuff, it is a really rather beautiful thing. And this isn't going to be a very technical talk at all, but I will briefly describe the main parts of a skull. It has this habit of rotating a lot. Try to do it. Yes. Well, anyway, you can probably, whether it rotates or not, it doesn't really matter. The big part on the top
is the cranium, as I'm sure you all know. No, principal job is to house the brain. That's the brain case. These are the eye sockets, of course. This is the lower part of the mandible. So there are essentially two parts to a skull, made basically of about 26 bones. These things are the zygomatic arches. In a human being, there are cheeks. The auditory bulli, if it's very big, it's an animal that has a need to hear very acutely, like in a hare, for instance, a very large auditory bulli. And this thing here is there's the sagittal ridge, to which the muscles are attached, which open and close the mandible. So if you have a big sagittal ridge, it's likely that you're an animal that bites down onto tigers, for instance, have very big sagittal ridges. And the front part, and you can't see it over here, but the front part is known as the rostrum, and it's basically where the nose or the beak or the bill or the horns are, or in our case, human case, the rostrum is essentially the face. So that is a basic skull, as you can see, a very beautiful thing. And so Alan thought, well, this is terrific. I'll try and collect one or two more of these. And so his next thing was a newt. And this is his first newt, which, as you can see, is very different. It has a very different kind of mandible. Still got the eye sockets. The zygomatic arches are a different shape. Has virtually no brain case because a newt isn't exactly the brainiest animal in creation. But different and not unattractive. Then tremendously attractive was this, which he got, which is a firefish, a broad-barred firefish, which some nice aquarium owner gave to him. And this, I think, was the moment when he decided that he would start making a sort of systematic collection of skulls. And I should say something about the way he prepared them. The first one, as I told you, he scraped away the flesh, and he did that again with the newt as well. Obviously, a slightly different procedure, no fur, more gelatinous and scaly and unpleasant. Then he, as he started to build up his collection, he talked to other skull collectors and found that the thing to do was to immerse them in large numbers of maggots, and maggots just eat away all the soft flesh. But the problem with maggots is, and there's a kind of beetle called a domestic beetle, which does the same sort of job, is that when confronted with an enormous amount of free meat, as it were, they go completely berserk with a sort of feeding frenzy. And they, if they had elbows, they'd be elbowing each other out of the way to get at the flesh. And the problem with that is that when you've got an animal with very delicate bones, I mean, this clearly has, although they're actually cartilage, not bones, but with something that has got very fine filigree bones in its nose, they will break them. And so Alan had to come up with another means, and he went to what may seem the most primitive of all kinds of cleaning of a skull, but that's called cold water maceration, where you simply put the skull in a bucket of cold water and leave it there for 6 or 8 months. And the bacteria in the water or that land on the surface of the water, they do, and much more gently, the job that the maggots would do. But the downside of this is that the water goes jet black and begins to smell absolutely terrible. So it was at this point, he was now about 28 years old and had about 70 skulls, but now he had lots of buckets of black, very smelly water dotted around the house, and it was at this moment that his wife decided to leave him. So poor Alan is now, has 70 skulls, lots of buckets, and she took the children as well, living alone in this rather dreary house, in this rather dreary city. Well, it did, he thought, give him one advantage, though. It freed up a bedroom. And so he decided he would turn this bedroom into his collecting room, and this is what it looks like now. This is Alan Dudley's bedroom, dominated by an enormous hippopotamus skull in the middle, and a few examples of his taxidermy, but basically hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of skulls. There's the door through which Mrs. Dudley used to come and go. Michelangelo. So this is his collection room, and it is an extraordinary collection. there are tens of millions of species of creatures on this planet. 58,000 only, however, are classed as chordates and therefore have a backbone and most likely a skull. And they're divided into five classes, the mammals, the birds, the fishes, the amphibians, and the reptiles. And Alan has pretty well covered all of those five classes. Hundreds of mammals. If he's weak in any area, it's amphibians, but lots and lots of good reptiles, thousands of birds, thousands of fishes. And this is a collection that is world class. I mean, he gets his animals principally nowadays from zoos. Occasionally he deals with other collectors. But basically, if I can find the fellow, a zoo keeper will say, you know, we've got a hippopotamus who's feeling rather unwell. When finally it pops its clogs, as we say back home, would you come and cut its head off and then put it in a bucket, or obviously a rather big bucket, and after a few months or years, it'll turn into this, an absolutely magnificent specimen of a hippopotamus. So it is a collection which is almost certainly the largest collection in private hands anywhere in the world. But he got him into trouble, and this is why there was this story in the Daily Mail. Because I think it was the 4th of March 2008, he was just about getting out of bed, as he tells it, for another exciting day of veneer selecting. And there was a hammering on the front door, and he went down, and there were four policemen there. There was an officer from the Customs and Excise Department. There was a chap from the Wildlife Protection Service who had come all the way down from Edinburgh in Scotland. And there were two uniformed officers, unarmed, of course, this being Britain, but who were there as muscle in case the situation got ugly. But, I mean, Alan is the gentlest, nicest. I mean, he's a classic nerd. There was no chance at all that he was, going to turn violent or anything. So he said, what do you want? And they said, well, we have reason to believe, having looked at the internet, that you've probably got some skulls that we think you ought not to have. So I'm afraid you've got to stay in the kitchen, and we're going to go upstairs and look at your skull collection in your former wife's bedroom and go through it painstakingly and decide, you know, whether everything that you have is what you should have. And at the end of the day, they came down and said, well, I'm really sorry, Mr. Dudley, but the fact of the matter is you've got five specimens that you shouldn't have. You've got a loggerhead turtle, you've got a particular type of penguin, you've got something called a Goldie's marmoset, you've got a chimpanzee, and you've got a tiger. And all five of these animals you're forbidden from trading in under the Convention for the International Trafficking in Endangered Species. So I'm afraid you're under arrest, at least. We're going to have to charge you, and you're going to have to go to court and explain yourself. So what happened to Alan, it was sort of bizarre. First of all, they made him, actually took a photograph of it. I find it quite easily, I think. They made him wear one of these. This is actually Alan's foot with a hole in his sock, I see. An ankle bracelet, which was finely calibrated to do two things. They put crime scene tape over the front door of his wife's bedroom, and it was calibrated such that he couldn't go in there. He could go to his own bedroom, which was very close, but if he went under the crime scene tape, all sorts of alarms would go off. And the other thing was he couldn't leave the city of Coventry, which is something that I think most people probably rather would like to do. But, so not being able to go to Coventry, having no wife, buckets of smelly water, and not being able to look at your collection, life for Alan was somewhat purgatory. And it was at this stage that I went over to see him to talk to him about the idea of doing this app. And he was a bit morose, but I mean, he said, you can come upstairs and you, Simon, can go under the crime scene tape and you can hand me skulls and ask what they are and things, but I can't go under it. And that was the situation that obtained for about 4 months until he actually came to trial. And then the judge gave him a fairly severe wigging because apparently the loggerhead turtle, I think it was, I forget which one it was. I think it was the loggerhead turtle. had shown, I think there were bullet holes in it that showed that it had been hunted, but the one he had bought of three on the internet wasn't in any way damaged, but that was no excuse. He just simply shouldn't have had the beasts at all. He pleaded guilty. The judge said, you know, simply overzealous, you're clearly not an Al Capone type figure. And so he confiscated the five offending skulls. He told him not to do it again. Fined him, I think, £2,500, and sentenced him to prison for 2 years, but suspended the sentence for 2 years. So providing he didn't do anything wicked, he was free to go. And that was the situation when we decided to do this app. And briefly, I'll show you the collection, which is the dominant part of this app. We chose about 300 or 400 of the skulls, and in every case, you go to something like a barn owl, there is the barn owl, and there is its skull, and you can double-click on the thing, and you can expand it or contract it, and you can view it in 3D, left to right, and do all sorts of magical and amusing things with it. And there are lots and lots of skulls of all sorts of creatures, catfish, toads, condors. Rather amusingly, I don't know if this will work, if I go to a human skull, if I can find a human skull, there's a human skull. As you notice, on the left, they put the species example, and on the right, the skull. Well, when they did the human, when they chose there's the species example. And I think that's probably because there was more of my skull readily visible than for most people. But anyway, the reason I think that they got me involved in this was not so much to write about the collection. There's a lot of very good and serious biological information if you click on the collection and if you look on the book as a collection. But they wanted to know how the skull fitted into human society generally. How do we regard skulls? Why do we have this fascination with skulls? I mean, even if you go back to grave sites 5,000-6,000 years old, the skull is always in a position of great reverence. I mean, one might ask, it may sound rather glib and trivial to ask it, why, for instance, the pelvis through which birth occurs isn't revered, why the rib cage houses the heart and the lungs, why not the longest bone in the body, the femur, something like that. Why always the skull? Well, it's fairly obvious. Even before people knew actually what the brain that it is designed to protect, what it did, there was a sort of a general consensus view that it housed the personality, the spirit of the person who owned the skull. Plus the skull had the orifices through which one can see and smell and taste and speak and so on and so forth and hear. So clearly it was very, very important. And it has been regarded in history as the most important part of a former human body. And so what I did in this was to look at certain specific aspects of human society and behaviour which involve skulls. And what, with your indulgence, I'll do tonight is just to choose four of these areas and explore them in a tiny bit more detail. And I want to begin, and I think for most of this I'm going to stand here, so I hope that's all right with everybody in terms of hearing me, because I'm going to have to play with this machine a little. And, there is one of those. Oh, great. This is for people asking questions, is it?
No, that's for you.
Oh, it's for me. No, thank you. So, the skull in art. Now, the skull, as you'll be aware of, if you're not aware, you'll see it readily, has been for a long time the subject of artists. Leonardo there, Dürer on the right, marvellous agate skull, I think that's from China, this somewhat bizarre anti-smoking ad by Van Gogh. This beautiful turquoise skull with malachite and obsidian and eyes made of pyrites, worn as a mask. I think it's Aztec, I believe it is, I'm not sure. But what I want to concentrate on tonight is this extraordinary painting, which I'm sure you'll all be familiar with, by Hans Holbein. And it's called The Ambassadors, and it was painted in, I think, 1538. And it depicts two people who were both ambassadors from France. The chap on the left who actually commissioned the painting is a man called Jean de Danteville. And the chap on his right, or on the right of the painting, is his friend Georges de Selve. They're both, despite their mature appearance, only in their 20s. I think de Danteville is the younger of the two. He's 25. Georges de Selve is 29. And de Danteville was the French ambassador to London at the time, or to the court of St. James. De Selve was the French ambassador to Venice. And Holbein painted them at a specific time of enormous turmoil in the religious world. And he wanted, maybe he was asked by de Danteville to do this, to depict this turmoil with a variety of beautifully executed symbols. Just by de Danteville's left hand, you can see a sort of cylindrical object, which if you blew it up, you'd see shows, it's a sort of astrolabe, and it shows the date on which that this depicts, which is the 4th of April, 1533. I think it's 1533, Good Friday, 1533, which immediately invests it with some religious significance. It's also just a few days after Henry VIII divorced or attempted to divorce Anne Boleyn, incurring the wrath of the Pope, Clement VII, I think it was, and beginning the schism which created the Church of England when England or the English monarchy broke with Rome. And so all of the symbols between the two ambassadors have some resonance with that turmoil. The globe, for instance, has, if you look at it carefully, Rome at its centre. The open book, however, is a text written by Martin Luther, the architect of Protestantism. The lute has a broken string, a sort of symbolic indication of turmoil or something that needs to be repaired. So one could go through all of these things and show the underlying feature of this picture is turmoil. It is, incidentally, an enormous picture. It's bigger than it is there. It's 7 foot by 7 foot. It's at the National Gallery in London. It's oil on oak. And it's a thing of great beauty, wonderfully detailed. But the most peculiar aspect of it, the cleverest aspect in a way, is that strange smear across the lower third of it from the bottom left to the middle right. And that, de Danteville said, as many wealthy and aristocratic people who commissioned portraits in that time said to the artist, that however rich and distinguished I am, I want you, Mr. Painter, to include something in this painting as a memento mori, a reminder that in the end we die. So de Danteville said to Holbein, somewhere in this picture, which is going to be full of all other kinds of symbolism, you must put in a memento mori. And so Holbein did as was instructed in this clever, clever device, which initially just looks like a smear. Now, I'm sure you all know from school what it actually is, but while I'm here, I suppose, theoretically, to suggest that you buy the book, the app allows you to display exactly what this does. And I'll show you, if I can. So, basically, this app, we've written this rather clever sort of calculation, which shows that if you look at that, it's called an anamorphosis. It's the same kind of technique that is used on television broadcasts of football games. Something distorted is broadcast in a way that when you look at it from a certain angle, it becomes instantly recognizable. Just like this turns from being a meaningless sort of smear into a really rather lovely and beautifully executed, sometimes gets a bit wild, skull. And the way that this was suspended was at the top of a spiral staircase, such that as you went up to it, you could see a skull. Then as you got closer, it became this smear. And then when you passed it again, you could look down on it, and the skull would be evident once again. So having this app will at least prevent you doing what an awful lot of people at the National Gallery do, which is get down on their hands and knees and sort of zoom in elegantly up past them and say, oh, yeah, ah, that's what it's all about. So this is what it's all about, just at a finger stroke. So that was one aspect of the skull that I thought you might find interesting. Another I look at in, there are two examples in this particular chapter, in the whole field of science and pseudo, I'm sorry, I seem to be at the front of all of these things. Scientific interest in the skull really began at the beginning of the last century. That's the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. And it was occasionally put to very bad use indeed. I mean, there was this American eugenicist called Morton, I think, who did a very detailed series of calculations, of measurements, of thousands of skulls which the US Army had collected in Leavenworth in Kansas after one of the more savage periods of Indian wars. And Morton and a number of other like-minded people at the time measured them, the science of craniometry, of the measurement of the skull, very, very fine measurements and comparisons. And he came up with the idea, or others came up with the idea at the same time, that skulls could be classified broadly into two types, dolichocephalic or brachycephalic. Dolichocephalic tend to be sort of rather long, aquiline-nosed, slender skulls. A greyhound has a dolichocephalic skull, whereas a bulldog, for instance, has a much squatter kind of a brachycephalic skull. But the trouble was, although this measurement was absolutely fine and dandy, Morton and people like him adopted it, created a hierarchy out of it, and said such things as, people with dolichocephalic skulls are clearly intellectually or morally superior to those with brachycephalic skulls. And I regret to say this, but this was seized upon in the Third Reich. Jews clearly have, compared to Aryans, less well-formed skulls. Black people, similarly. And so two sets of extremely unpleasant people seized on this research, said craniometry offers an answer for theories of racial superiority, and all sorts of dreadful things eventuated. So there are many instances where the scientific attitude of the skull was put to very bad ends indeed. Not the case here with phrenology, which is probably the most famous, I suppose, but also the most ludicrous. It was initiated by these two Germans in the middle of the 19th century, who came up with a not unreasonable view, I mean, one that's confirmed today by modern neurology, that the brain in certain areas is adapted for certain intellectual purposes. So mathematical ability might be your left frontal lobe. If you're a great Lothario, it might be somewhere towards the back of your the right side of your brain. If you're a painter, it might be left side or whatever. The Germans identified 39 areas of things like amativeness and vitiviveness, the love of life. Where they went slightly wrong was that they said, if you have a particular propensity for, let's say, seducing people, then the part of your brain that is the heart of your seductive appetite will grow, it'll bulge. That's a reasonable thing to say, I suppose. But what is unreasonable is to then suppose that that bulge is transmitted through the skull and into a lump on the outside of your head. And that if you, a man or a person with delicate fingers, could very gently feel your surface of your head, he would come up in a few moments with the notion that your proclivities in some area, your moral standing or whatever, was such and such. Well, it's complete balderdash. And if I can give you one rather sad example which illustrates this, the brain, or rather the skull, is a very, very solid piece of kit. Not in a baby, of course, but in an adult, it's simply, it'll crack, as you know all too well, but it won't expand thanks to pressure from the brain within. There was an awful case in Britain 5 or 6 years ago when six young students agreed to take part in a drug test of a new substance being peddled by a German pharmaceutical company. They were paid £1,000 each, I think.
And they, all six of them, suffered what's called a cytokine storm, which is a massive, massive allergic reaction. And they, within moments, their heads, their shoulders, chests expanded vastly, their faces and went 3 and 4 times the normal size. They looked like cauliflowers, and their shoulders were vast, and of course they were terribly, terribly ill. They all lived, I'm happy to say, being given antihistamines in very large quantities. But the crucial thing is that they suffered, they looked, people said, like the elephant man. But the reason they suffered such terrible pain is that their brains tried to expand but couldn't expand because the skull is so immobile. It simply will not allow any expansion of the brain within. And if it tries, as with meningitis, you get very, very severe pains. So the science was nonsense. However, it didn't stop this man, Lorenzo Fowler, from setting up shop in Fleet Street, just oddly enough, beside where the offices of the Daily Mail were for many years, sort of an appropriate sort of kinship going on there. And he published a book and sold 500,000 copies. And young women mainly would come to his consulting rooms and pay 2 guineas each to have him run his fingers over their, through their hair and over their heads, to discover, for instance, I don't know if you can see this, but just above the left eye, calculation. And I don't know, people are doing it. People try to pretend they're merely scratching their heads, but in fact, a number of people in all audiences I've spoken to feel the tops of their left eyes just to see whether they might be good at calculation. Well, really don't bother, because this is total pseudoscience. It's complete nonsense. And although Mr. Fowler made himself a great deal of money, he was fairly soon run out of town by the efforts of one man who is famous, a medical doctor, famous for a completely different set of reasons, and that's Peter Mark Roget of Roget's Thesaurus, who wrote a paper in, I think it was 1895 or so, denouncing the nonsensical pseudoscience that people like Fowler were making large amounts of money from, and essentially forcing him to close his practice down and be derided as a charlatan. And Fowler had the, or rather Roget had the last laugh, because if you look in Roget's Thesaurus today, you'll see that phrenology is listed along with palmistry and astrology as being just one of those pieces of pseudoscientific craziness that most sensible people don't believe in. So that's one scientific area that amused me, but there was another which will probably be equally familiar to you, but it's maybe worth reminding you of the salient details of it. And that's, if I can find this chap, come on, there he is. Yes, exactly, Piltdown Man. Looks uncannily like Hitler, it's very strange, but this is not Hitler. Oh, incidentally, I should say one thing, going back to art for a second. You may wonder why possibly the most famous piece of skull art isn't in this, and that is Damien Hirst's skull. I wish it was Damien Hirst's skull, but a skull that he owned, called The Love of God. It was made about 8 years ago, after he had done the shark and the sheep and all these things. His mother said to him, "Oh, Damien, for the love of God, what are you going to do next?" And he said, "I've just bought in an antique shop the skull of a young man, probably from the early 18th century, probably from Marseille or some northern Mediterranean port," which allows me to talk about the very briefly about the occasional problems of buying a skull in an antique shop. Very famous story of a man that went into an antique shop in London, let's say, and saw this magnificent skull, which the dealer said it was the skull of, let us say, I'm not sure exactly who it was, but let's say William the Fourth, King William the Fourth, the one just before Victoria. And was enormously awed by this, and it was for sale, and eventually they agreed on a price, and several thousand pounds, and he bought it, and he walked out with the skull of King William the Fourth, delighted. But just as he was leaving the shop, he noticed a very similar-looking skull on a plinth to the right of the door and said idly to the shopkeeper, what was that? And he said, oh, that's William the Fourth as well, but that's when he was a baby. The Damien Hirst thing, as you probably know, for the love of God, he took this skull, he put a thin platinum coating on it, and then studded into it 8,500 diamonds, including one beautiful pink diamond over the centre of the forehead. And he then said, this is the most expensive piece of art in the world, and I'm going to sell it at auction for £57 million. Well, no one bought it, effectively, and he had to form a consortium and buy it back himself for £35 million, and it now goes around the world in a variety of exhibitions. Well, to take these photographs is extremely complicated. It involves putting them on a turntable, rotating them, stopping them every half degree, so that's 720 times, and taking a lot of high-definition photographs, which then allow you to rotate it and expand it and contract it as you wish. We got permission from Damien Hirst to do this, armed guards. It was a real performance. The photographs, I mean, as you can see from this, they're very high-definition, beautiful photographs. But when he, Damien, saw the photograph that we had taken, he complained that it wasn't sparkly enough. So the photography is done by a chap called Nick Mann in Chicago, and he and his team arranged an algorithm which would add sparkle to each of the diamonds and by hand made every diamond just a tiny bit more sparkly, so that when we saw it, it looked like the most amazing firework display you've ever seen. But still, Damien said, no, it's still not sparkly enough. Plus, he also, I think, didn't much care for the essay I had written about him, which was slightly less sort of a hagiography than I think he'd normally accustomed to. And so he argued and argued and argued, and in the end, we said, well, we're just not going to include it. So to anyone who was expecting Damien Hirst's For the Love of God, I regret it is not in this app. However, this chap is, and I think he's actually a great deal more interesting. Basically, the story of Piltdown Man revolves around an extremely ambitious, very pompous Sussex lawyer called Charles Dawson, who, very, very full of himself, he was an amateur archaeologist and a very successful lawyer who dressed, you can see from his official portraits, he wears a tricorn hat and velvet knee breeches and a sword and not stirrups, what do you call those things, spurs, and not the kind of thing that would induce you to go to him as a lawyer, I imagine, but still. But he also was fascinated by archaeology, and so he was walking one day in 1908, and there was a quarry that they were digging stone for some new houses, and he went walking and found a number of fragments of a cranium. And he instantly thought these are rather odd, because they appear to be of an adult, but of an adult with a very small brain case, smaller than the brain case of a modern human. So perhaps, just perhaps, this is a very, very early skull. The gravels in this quarry were Pleistocene, so what, 975,000 years. So this could be important. He went up to London to the British Museum, where the head of the geology department, a figure of towering rectitude called Arthur Smith Woodward, when he saw these, he said, this is extremely important. Let me come down with you to the quarry in Piltdown, and we will search together. Well, over the next 2 years, they searched and they found a nearly complete cranium. They found a jawbone, this jawbone here, bits of a jawbone anyway, which had all the characteristics of an ape, and found teeth which showed a much more sophisticated omnivorous diet than apes were known to eat. So putting these three things together, the cranium, the fragments, the mandible, and the teeth, Arthur Woodward, who was, as I say, a figure of enormous, respected all around the world, a man totally humorless, and absolutely devoted to work. He, in 42 years in the British Museum, took only half a day off and that the entire time, and that was because he broke his arm. He stood up in 1912 to make the announcement that
everyone in Britain, everyone in the paleontological world was awaiting, that he had discovered the missing link. You've got to remember, 1859, Darwin on the Origin of Species showed that, or suggested that humankind probably descended from or is in some way associated with the ape. Teilhard de Chardin had found Peking man. Evidence was accruing that mankind had indeed descended from the ape, but there had been, at this juncture, nothing found that was sufficiently half-ape, half-man to suggest it was the missing link. It was missing, and it caused paleontologists great frustration. Well, this, said Arthur Woodward, was it. And the crowning glory of this discovery, which he named Eoanthropus Dawsoni, after Dawson, the man who had found it, was that the missing link, to everyone's delight, and this was at the height of the British Empire, the missing link was an Englishman. Not just an Englishman, a Sussex gentleman, like Charles Dawson. So it was given pride of place at the British Museum from 1912 onwards, and here it was, this extraordinary creature, proof positive that Darwin was right and that it was an Englishman that proved him to be so. Well, that was the case until the 1950s. And during those 40 intervening years, other evidence had come to light which suggested that this perhaps wasn't quite what it was supposed to be. Most notably, it was well known that bones that lie in earth absorb an awful lot of the chemical fluorine, and that when these bones, the British Museum allowed it to be examined, were tested, hardly any fluorine at all. And then they discovered on further examination that in fact the skull was probably about 50,000 years old. It was primitive, probably from Germany. The jawbone was that of an orangutan, which had come from Sarawak. It had been painted with potassium bichromate to turn it the sort of orangey yellow that made it look antique. And the two molar teeth that had been discovered under the microscope, little fragments of metal, suggesting that it had been filed down with a file. So the whole thing was an elaborate hoax on the British Museum and indeed on the entire archaeological world. But the question was, who had perpetrated it? A number of people initially thought it was Arthur Conan Doyle, who lived nearby and had a sort of puckish sense of humour about these things. For various reasons, some people said it was Teilhard de Chardin himself, who had possibly reasons. But in the end, no one thought it was Arthur Woodward, who was a completely respectable chap. But then they looked at Charles Dawson's papers and in his house. They had both died by this time. Huge memorial to Charles Dawson's distinguished work. And they found in Dawson's collections that he had been devoted an entire lifetime to making fake objects of one kind or another. There was a Chinese bronze urn, which was neither Chinese nor bronze. There was a whale, an elephant's tusk, some kind of instrument which had been cut with a metal bandsaw. So he was a faker. He was, if you like, the Jason Blair of the paleontological world. And although they never took the memorial down, the British Museum decided to take this fellow and take him off out of the pride of place and put him in a back storeroom, never to be seen again, or at least only with great difficulty. And that is the story of Piltdown Man. And I want to finish this up with one other fellow, if I've got time. Do I have time? What's the time doing? Yes. Good, jolly good. This is a story of a chap I came to know quite well. Rather disagreeable and ugly fellow. And I can go back, actually, to the front, I think, for a moment, and just leave you to gaze at this person. He's called Kara Mustafa Pasha. And he's a dissolute, unpleasant man. The reason you can't see the left-hand side of his face is that he fell in a fire during a drunken orgy and burned most of his face. He was the Ottoman Grand Vizier, the general, if you like, who superintended an army of 300,000 Ottomans, 20,000 Janissaries, who in the 1680s besieged the city of Vienna. As you remember, the Ottomans had this intention of sweeping across Europe and ultimately getting to Rome.
Vienna was one of the cities en route. They decided to lay siege to it. The courageous Viennese held them off for the better part of a year. And there are two sort of rather nice little gastronomic side notes to this story, which I'm sure you'll know well, but it's quite amusing to remind them. If you can imagine, these 300,000 soldiers led by this man were at the bottom of the walls inside Vienna, people getting hungry, desperate, frustrated. The bakers had very little flour to work with, but they were on this particular day making bread supplies for the people within, and they heard underneath the ovens a sound which to them suggested that these wretched Turks were trying to tunnel under the walls. So they told the soldiers, the sentries up top, and the sentries looked over the walls and indeed saw the backsides of lots of Turks scrabbling away like moles, and did whatever they used to do, boiling oil or whatever. Anyway, the Turks fled and the tunneling stopped. And the next day, or a day or so later, the combined armies of the Poles and the Swedes, who were the allies with the Viennese, swept in and relieved the siege. So the siege was over, and the Ottomans in full retreat down towards Istanbul. And the authorities decided, in gratitude to the bakers, to allow them to make henceforward a ceremonial bread roll in the shape of the Islamic crescent, the Turkish crescent, to show that they had vanquished them. And that was, of course, the croissant. So if you, at your breakfast tomorrow morning, have a croissant, do remember, raise a cappuccino to the memory of the noble bakers of Vienna who saved the day. So what happened was the Turks fled eastwards and stopped briefly in Budapest, which was a city they had already captured. And it was at that point, and somewhat expectedly, Kara Mustafa Pasha was greeted by a delegation from Istanbul, from the Sultan, Mehmet IV, who said, as is usual in these circumstances, "Well, I'm afraid you've lost a battle, so I'm afraid you've got to die. But you have this privilege of being allowed to choose the way you die." And he said, "I would like to be strangled." And they said, "Well, that's fine, we'll get the court strangler." And they did have one. Both the Chinese and the Turks had court stranglers, and they brought one up from Istanbul. And the way they did it was with a string from a longbow. So he detached the string and wrap it around Kara Mustafa's neck. And you, with some skill and determination, you tighten it and loosen it and tighten it and loosen it. And you can keep a chap alive for half an hour or so forth, which is what apparently happened in his case, before finally he died. They cut his head off, and they sent the head down to Istanbul for Mehmet IV to accept that it was indeed Kara Mustafa Pasha, and then they returned the head to the body, buried both together in Budapest, and then moved off back as an army down to Istanbul. That was how it would have remained, except that a couple of years later, the pursuing Viennese, Austro-Hungarians, swept down and took Budapest, which, of course, you only got to look at the architecture. St. Stephen's Cathedral, their influence has been great in Budapest ever since, and sent the Turks running away. And one of the things they did was that they found the grave of their nemesis, and they decided to dig up the head. They said, "You can have the body, take it back and bury it in Turkey, but we Viennese, we'd like the head." And so they took the skull of Kara Mustafa back to Vienna and put it on display in a museum, the Stadtmuseum in Vienna. And there it has been essentially ever since. Well, at least that's what I thought. In 1999, I covered the invasion of Kosovo and decided I wanted to write a short book about the Balkans. And the way I would do it was to take a long, sort of sinuous journey from the two polar ends, if you like, of the conflict, Vienna and Istanbul. And I knew about the head and the body. I knew the head was in Austria and the body was in Turkey. So I thought I'd like to see both as a sort of piece of rather crude literary symbolism, if you like. So I wrote to the director of the Stadtmuseum in Vienna and said, "Can I come and see the head of Kara Mustafa Pasha?" And he said, "No, I'm afraid you can't." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, in 1972, the Turks had a big upsurge of nationalist feeling, and they did two things. They went, first of all, to the Japanese and said, 'We Turks think it is outrageous that you have your brothels, known as generally Turkish baths. If a man was feeling in a mood for a brothel, he would look for a sign saying Turku.' and we want that expunged. And the Japanese acceded to the request, and indeed now, I'm sure none of you would ever wish to visit such an institution, but just in case, they're now known as Soaparanda, Soapland. So what was a Turkish bath is now Soapland, and if you want to believe that that's where you get a good washing, well, believe it as you will. Anyway, it's much more anodyne. So the Turkish name is stricken from that, from the water trade in Japan. They all then, having succeeded in Japan, they then went to the Austrian government and the Viennese and said, we would like the head of Kara Mustafa Pasha back, because we think it's an outrage that the head of a Turkish national is just gawped over by tourists in Vienna. And the director of the Stadt Museum said, well, you can't have him back, but we will take him off display. So we'll put him in the basement. And that's as much of a concession as we're willing to make. So when I wrote, they said, no, you can't see it. It hasn't been seen since 1972. But, said the director, you can perhaps come here and make your case. And so it was just like an Oxford tutorial. I went down to Vienna, went to this book-lined study in the Stadt Museum, and there was this tweedy chap with a pipe. And I had to sit there making a sort of intellectual case for why I should be allowed to see the head of this long-dead Grand Vizier. But it seemed to work, because after about half an hour of my spluttering and making complete nonsense, I'm sure, he did this wonderful thing. He pressed a button on his desk, and a secretary came in, and he said, Fraulein, would you take this distinguished gentleman downstairs to meet our other distinguished gentleman? And it was a great moment. I was taken down to the basement, and there was an enormous cardboard box among the tins of paint and things with written on the side, Herr K. Mustafa. And an assistant undid the sellotape and lifted out this vitrine, and there inside it was the skull of this man with a little bit of hair on the top, rather like me, I suppose. Four or five rotten old-looking teeth, and miraculously, the bowstring still wrapped around his neck. So he and I sort of communed, as it were, for a little while, and then I took off and went and looked for the body 6 months later. And that's the other little gastronomic note, because his body isn't actually in Istanbul. It's in a town called Giresun, which used to be a Roman fort town called Keresus, which is the town where the first cherry trees were grown. So if you happen to go to some bake shop tomorrow morning and have croissant with cherry jam, you will have the entire history of the Balkans on your breakfast plate. So I just want to say, oh, and I should say as a footnote to that, when we were arranging the photographs for this app and the book, we wanted to know where, if we could come and take a photograph, I mean, probably have to go through the same procedure as in 1999, of Kara Mustafa, and they said, no, you can't, because your book created such a fuss when it was published in 2000, and people came from all over the place to look at this fellow again and asked to come and see the cardboard box, that in about 2004, whoever was the director there decided simply to get rid of it. So one rainy night, he apparently took it to a cemetery that he's now dead, he went, it was never disclosed, put it in a pauper's grave. It is somewhere in the soil of Austria, but no one will ever know where Kara Mustafa Pasha is. And I want to say one final thing, which has nothing to do with Kara Mustafa Pasha, which is, goes back to Alan Dudley. I asked him, on one time I saw him, if his collection, if his fire, his house, was ever consumed by fire, what one skull would he save? And he decided he would save that. A two-headed cow, as it were, a Siamese cow or a conjoined cow. And he got it from a farmer and put it presumably in a very big bucket and let lots of bacteria work on it. But of all the skulls he's got, some of them most exquisite, and tigers and penguins and marmosets and so forth, this is what he treasures above all else. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. And if there is anything I can try and answer a question, I'd love to have a bash if anyone's got any questions. At the back, sir.
Just with your last slide there, how old was that cow with the two heads?
It's an adult cow. It survived for a long time. Oh, yes, and of course some nasty little boy in Seattle the other day said, why hadn't you got film of it wandering around the field, and couldn't I see the actual cow? So, but yes, it's. I don't actually think. Well, no, we don't have a photograph of what it looked like, because with a fox, you just take a photograph of a fox, but you'd have to look high and low for another two-headed cow, I assume. But I assure you that if we ever find a two-headed cow, we will photograph it and put it in the app as well. Two-faced cow, exactly, yes, yes. Theatrical cow. Ma'am.
So even though we all think phrenology is a good laugh and everything, but it's true that we still use the terms lowbrow, middlebrow, and highbrow, which come from that. Is that so?
Well, absolutely, and it also comes from the Neanderthal, as you're well aware, notably very lowbrow. So I think it's slightly deeper than that. I mean, our belief that if you've got a big forehead, you're brainy, and to an extent, of course, that might be true. I've got an enormous forehead; it goes right to the back of my head. But I think what we don't do is say that we have bumps on our head which correspond to particular areas, particular proclivities. I think we accept, as Peter Mark Roget said, that this is bunkum, baloney, hogwash. Right, well, if there's nobody else, thank you very much indeed for coming. It's very kind of you.
So please remember there are books for sale, and Mr. Winchester will be happy to sign here at the front. Thanks for coming.